Okay, so today is Thursday, August 22nd. We are going to start back in your course pack on page 15. So when we talked about inorganic compounds in class on Tuesday, we talked about them being molecules or compounds that lacked a lot of carbon in them. That's a typical rule. It's not a hard and fast rule. We're also going to find that a lot of these inorganic compounds are ionically bonded together. When we talk about ionic bonding, what happens to the electrons in that molecule or compound?
Transferred.
Good. So, in fact, these electrolytes are ionically bonded together. They are going to break apart into their ions when we place them in water. What that means is if you've got sodium chloride, which makes up table salt, the sodium and the chlorine break up from each other into their cation and anion. So we've got a positively charged sodium, and then we'll have a negatively charged chlorine. And that is what's in your bloodstream. So acids, bases, and salts fall into this category. And these are some common electrolytes that we're going to see throughout both Bio-210 and 211. You'll notice that we've got sodium. Notice the positive charge on the symbol there. What does that plus charge tell you?
It's a cation.
It's a cation. Good. And do cations lose electrons or gain electrons? They lose. Notice calcium there with a 2 plus. How many electrons has it lost?
Two.
It's lost 2. Where do you think calcium is mostly stored?
Bones.
Mostly in your bones. Good. There is a certain amount that should circulate in your bloodstream. It's really important for muscles to contract and nerves to work properly. So if you don't have enough in your bloodstream, your body can't say, right now you need to eat something with calcium. You will go and get it from your bones. So that's why you have to have an immediate storage supply available to your bloodstream. Potassium and sodium actually work together to maintain your hydration. You know, if you've ever been really sick with vomiting and diarrhea, somebody will probably say, hey, your electrolytes are out of balance. What do they recommend for you to drink or eat?
Gatorade.
Pedialyte. If you don't have those, they may say good old-fashioned chicken soup. What else? What'd you have?
Ginger ale.
Hey, if you got nothing else, right? Okay, so, you know, Pedialyte, Gatorade, great sources of electrolytes. If you've ever had Pedialyte, you know it's nasty tasting, right? Kind of salty. And so that's some of those electrolytes in there. It's really important to have those, because if you don't have your sodiums and your potassiums and even magnesium, then you start to lose the fluids that you take in.
Would that group always be cations?
Those will always be cations. The anions are always going to be the ones that gain one or more electrons. Chlorine is something that makes up your stomach acid. Bicarbonate and phosphate are actually part of what we call buffer systems, and they help to maintain your blood's pH. They will wait for you in 211, and of course we'll talk about buffer systems in that course. Right. So we consider salts to be a type of electrolyte, and a lot of the salts and electrolytes in our bodies maintain osmosis, meaning they maintain water balance for us. If you go out and work in the yard and maybe mow or cut bushes or do some heavy duty work when it's really, really hot outside, you're going to start sweating, and you may sweat a lot. What is wrong with just replenishing your lost fluids with just plain old tap water? You don't get any electrolytes, exactly. So you're replacing the water back into your body, but you're not replacing the salt back into your body. So when we talk about osmosis or hydration and water balance, we have to include in the conversation the salts or electrolytes like sodium and potassium. You may know somebody who does construction work. They carry those salt packets with them. You know, that doesn't sound very appetizing to pop a salt packet when you're really sweaty, but you gotta have the salt back in your system to maintain proper hydration.
Would that help you from sweating?
It doesn't stop you from sweating. It just maintains your salt and water balance. Because if you sweat out salt and water and you only drink water, then your salt needs to be replenished as well. All right, so salts are considered electrolytes, ionically bonded. Same story here. They typically don't have a lot of carbons in them. They also don't have hydrogens or hydroxides. Hydrogen, H plus there, is something we find in another category of electrolytes. What category is that? What category of electrolytes releases hydrogens? Acids. Yeah. So the point here is that salts like sodium and potassium salts don't have hydrogens bonded to them, nor do they have hydroxides, OH, because OH is what's bonded to a base. So my point here is, if you're taking something like Gatorade into your system or Pedialyte, you're not drinking necessarily acids or bases for a pH balance, but rather you're looking for those salts, which are going to have, you know, sodiums and chlorines. There's your potassium. You're trying to replenish the salts that we are losing through either sweat or even through diarrhea and vomiting. You can lose those electrolytes. So let me repeat here. Salts are electrolytes. That means they are ionically bonded together. They don't have a lot of carbons in them. You'll notice by the examples, no carbons there. And another important point to appreciate about them is they're not acids and they're not bases. What do acids release? Yeah, hydrogens. And bases release? Hydroxides or hydroxyls, good. So the biggies in this category are your acids and your bases. Let's spend some time talking about them. The acids and bases in our bodies are still considered inorganic compounds. They're not really, you know, full of carbon atoms, so we put them in that category for that reason of being inorganic in nature. So acids tend to release hydrogens into solution. The hydrogen is what makes the solution acidic. So on your sheet there, you'll notice you've got an example of HCl, that's hydrochloric acid. Where do you find that in the body? That is stomach acid, yeah. And you know what? That is so strongly acidic that it can eat away the enamel on your teeth. So it is an insanely strong acid. It can actually make Swiss cheese of your esophagus and erode your teeth away. So pretty caustic acid. In fact, our stomach acid's on the range of around 1 or 2, and in terms of the pH scale, that's almost to the end of that scale. So you'll notice that 0 is considered to be our strongest acids. What are some other examples of acids in your body?
Saliva
is a good one, yeah. Good, so you got a blank there for examples. You could include stomach acid. Definitely add saliva. For most of us, urine falls in that category. Urine really depends on what you've eaten. Vaginal fluids. Even the oil on your skin is considered to be acidic. So thanks to the vaginal fluids being acidic and the oil being acidic, that prevents bacteria overgrowth on our skin and other parts of the body. Well, on the pH scale, we consider anything below 7 to be acidic. The further you go away from 7 and the closer to 0 you get, the stronger the acid becomes. What that means is, to be a strong acid, the chemical releases a lot of what? So to be a strong acid, that chemical releases a lot of hydrogens. So the more you go towards 0, the more hydrogen ions that chemical is releasing. As you come closer to 7, the neutral number on the pH scale, those chemicals don't release quite as many hydrogen ions. So we consider the acids close to 7 to be weak in nature. What do we call those acids close to 0? They're strong, yeah. All right, let's hop over 7. We'll talk about 7 in just a moment. If you head above 7 toward 14, you're on the side of the scale dealing with alkaline or basic chemicals. Where would you find your weakest bases?
Near
7. Near 7, right? And your strongest bases are near 14. Good. So you'll notice that bases tend to release something called hydroxide or hydroxyl. You can pick which one. This is not chemistry class. We won't dicker over the tiny detail there of which word to use. Nonetheless, it's O and H together. It's hydroxyl or hydroxide. So the chemicals on the base side of the scale release more and more as you get toward 14. All right, so in the human body, what are some examples of bases? Blood's a great one. Good. Pancreatic fluids is another example. Pancreatic fluids. Semen is also basic.
So let's talk about the pH scale. We know the pH scale runs from 0 to 14. We know that the extreme ends are where your strongest acids and bases are located. What is special about 7? It's neutral. Good. And what that means is, at a pH of 7, the chemicals release equal amounts of hydrogens and hydroxyls. So right at 7, at our neutral spot, the number of hydrogens actually equals the number of hydroxides or hydroxyls a chemical releases. I want to show you something fun about this. Right at 7.0, water is considered neutral. And tap water at home is probably a little under 7. It's probably a little bit acidic when it comes out of your tap. But right at 7.0, you know, neutralized water, deionized, should be right at 7. And so if you take hydrogen and hydroxyl and add them together, it gives us water. H2O. Yeah, so that's kind of a fun fact about 7. The pH scale is based on the log of 10. I know that we're getting into math territory right now. So what this means for us is every time you change numbers on the pH scale, you're changing tenfold in strength. So let's take acidic coffee as an example here. You know, sometimes people let coffee sit around and it smells really potent and strong. They brew it really strong. So let's say that somebody has really, really strong acidic coffee and we test it. We come up with a pH of 3. That's some stomach-eating coffee, right? Okay, so let's say that somebody else doesn't like coffee quite so strong. Theirs is with a pH of 4. There's a tenfold change between a pH of 3 and 4. So that doesn't sound like a whole lot, but that means there's 10 times as many hydrogens released by coffee with a pH of 3 as compared to coffee with a pH of 4. Let's do this. Let's say someone else likes coffee, but with a pH of 5. So this time we actually multiply. We're going to have coffee that is 100 times stronger at a pH of 3 than a pH of 5. I can also reverse it and say that coffee with a pH of 5 is 100 times less what? Less acidic than a pH of 3. I can also say this. 3 is 100 times more acidic than 5, but 5 releases 100 times more hydroxides than 3. You say, wait a minute, hydroxides, we're on the acid side, right? Mm-hmm. But as you move towards 7, you release less of what? You release less hydrogens, and you start actually releasing more hydroxides. What number means you release equal amounts?
7.
Yeah, right at 7. So, you know, that's one way to think about it is it's not just that you're releasing hydrogens under 7. You can actually release hydroxides, the base component, as you move towards 7. You know where this is going. Let's go up to 6. All right, so if you've got some really weak coffee with a pH of 6, how many times weaker is it over a pH of 3? It's 1,000 times weaker. So my helpful hint is not to add your 10s together. It's not 10 plus 10 makes it 20 or 30 or 40. It's always multiply those 10s together. And I'll give you a helpful way to do this. Let's take 6 minus 3. I want to know what the difference in strength is. That's 3, right? That's my superscript on a 10. Or if you want to work with the number, that's the number of zeros I've got. Okay, so that way you don't get tricked into, oh, let's add, no, I don't add, multiply. So there's 1,000 times difference between a pH of 6 and a pH of 3. So what is the difference in alkalinity between a pH of 7 and 8? 10. Which of those two pHs is stronger? 7 or 8?
8.
8 releases 10 times as many what as 7?
Hydroxides.
Or you could say 7 releases 10 times as many what as 8?
Hydrogens,
yeah. So as you're heading toward 0, you're releasing more and more hydrogens. As you're heading toward 14, you release more and more hydroxides. Good. Let me give you a moment to work on this one. What is the difference in strength between a pH of 8 and 10?
100.
Good. You can say 10 times 10.
What did you say?
It's 100 times difference.
Oh, okay.
Or you can do the little quick math trick there. What's the difference in alkalinity between 8 and 12?
10,000.
I'm going to have to do math. 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, you got it, 10,000. So which number, 8 or 12, releases 10,000 as many hydrogens?
8 releases 10,000 hydrogens.
Yeah, 8 releases 10,000 as many hydrogens as 12. Do you see how that works? Because 8 is moving closer to 0, right? I can reverse my language. I can say 12 releases 10,000 as many hydroxides because I'm heading toward 14. All right, so between 8 and 12, which number is the most acidic? 8. I know we're on the base side. I know that's confusing, right? Because you're talking about a base. But when you compare the two bases together, 8's more acidic than 12 is. And when you compare 8 and 12, which one's more alkaline? The 12 is, yeah. So I know it's confusing to talk about an acid when you're actually meaning a base, but when you're comparing two, you can use that language. Let's see, I think I have some blanks on the bottom of the page. Let me make sure we've got those. 7. What does it mean to be neutral? Yeah, hydrogens and hydroxides, they're released in equal amounts. Hydrogens and hydroxides are released in equal amounts. So at a pH of 7, hydrogen and hydroxides are released in equal amounts.
Did you do the first one?
Let's see, the first one.
pH of the
solution. Oh, it's just stating that, yeah, pH is how many hydrogens you've got in solution. It looks like it's asking a question, doesn't it? Let's see, down below you've got a couple more blanks to fill in. pH of 2 compared to 5, what's the difference in strength?
1,000.
1,000, good.
Compare 3 to 7, the difference is?
10,000.
Yeah, 10,000. Last one says a pH of 5 releases 1,000 times more what?
Hydrogen.
Hydrogens, H plus. Now you could flip-flop that sentence and use hydroxides, right? Mm-hmm. You could say 8 releases 1,000 times more hydroxides than 5. Feel okay with acids and bases?
A little bit,
okay. We can review those. Just want to run you through some chemical reactions there on page 17 if you have a course pack with you.
On page what?
17. You know, a lot of the stuff that we cover in this course, you may not really use in earnest until you get into Bio 211. And case in point is neutralization reactions. In Bio 211, you'll study a topic called acid-base balance. It'll be one of the last topics you cover. So if you take Bio 211 come spring semester, you're going to be doing this in April. So I don't really want to go a whole lot into detail about neutralization because you will see it again in many months down the road. And the other two here, you'll actually bounce off of those in 211 as well. The first one there is called a neutralization reaction. We sometimes call it an acid-base reaction, and those are your blanks. Neutralization is the reaction between an acid and a base. Notice what is made as a result of the neutralization reaction. Water and salt are made. And if you've ever taken, say, baking soda and vinegar and mixed them together, you've probably seen a pretty violent reaction. It actually isn't all that violent when you consider that those are pretty weak acids and bases, but they bubble up in foam. It's a great way to clean your pipes out. But nonetheless, that is an acid, the vinegar, and a base, the baking soda, that react together. So that's why if you take something like a Tums or an Alka-Seltzer, it can get rid of the gas in your body. It does create bubbles, but of course it either goes out one end or the other. So that is the whole point of taking something like those kinds of medications for an upset stomach. Where this is really important is for blood pH. In order for you to maintain blood pH of 7.35 to 7.45, we have to have these acid-base reactions occur in our bodies. And specifically, where they occur is in the bloodstream. You have two systems, your breathing or respiratory system and your renal or urinary system that help to get rid of extra acids and or bases. So your breathing rate and what your urine composition is a way for us to maintain acid-base. So that'll be something we come upon down the road. For now, let me just mention that you'll want to highlight the blood pH. It is 7.35 to 7.45. Did you already know that number? Good.
You said it's the blood pH?
Blood pH, a very tight range there, 7.35 to 7.45. If you head above 7.45, we consider this to be alkalosis territory. Technically, the word alkalosis means condition of alkaline. And of course, heading below 7.35 heads into acidosis territory. You cannot live if your pH drops in the bloodstream as low as 6.8 or lower. And when we get up to about 7.8 or 8.0 in the pH in the blood, we can die. So we don't have a whole lot of flex room in here. So that's why we have two systems that can help maintain blood pH. So the ideal range there is 7.35 to 7.45. We will talk more about buffers in Bio 211, but they help us to maintain this blood pH. And especially if you have strong acids or even strong bases added to the bloodstream, they try to maintain by buffering that pH back into this very tight, narrow range. So if we have blood pH of 7.6, would you consider 7.6 normal?
No.
Would you consider it acidic or alkaline?
Alkaline.
It is alkalosis, good. And if you've got a pH in the blood of 7.1, acidosis, right. What's that? Yeah, and that can be bad for the respiratory system, yeah. So that is a really great conversation when y'all get to Bio 211. Last little bit here, I just want to make sure that we're talking using the same language, kind of switching gears here, middle of page 17. When we talk about chemical reactions, monomers are building blocks. So what are polymers?
Bigger.
Bigger, yeah. So if you think of train cars, a single train car is a monomer. And if they take and link together multiple train cars, you've got now a polymer. And we can either hook them together to make a really long train, or we can take them apart and have little individual train cars. And that's all your body does with stuff. It either takes little pieces and links them together to make long polymers, or it takes the foods that you've eaten, polymers, and then it breaks them down into little itty-bitty building blocks called monomers. And that's basically what we do all the time, is we build and we break down, we remodel what we're dealing with in our bodies. So when we're building molecules, we call these endergonic reactions because specifically they require energy input. So I know if you went home today and said, okay, my job is to make a mess of my house, 10 minutes, right? And you could have a heck of a mess going on. However, if you go home today and you say, I got to clean up my house, yeah, 10 minutes, you hadn't even gotten one thing done, right? So energy is required for building. So, you know, if you're cleaning up your house and our bodies, if we're building new muscle or new tissue, you know, that takes time and that takes energy input. So specifically, these kinds of reactions that require energy are called endergonic, meaning energy into that reaction. So that's why if you're a little kid and you're growing, you gotta eat. The opposite reaction releases energy. It's called an exergonic reaction. The breakdown reactions that occur in your body actually do release energy. So like we talked, if you go home and make a mess, it's minutes and you've got yourself a mess going. So when you release energy from chemical reactions, then you are putting energy back into the system. And what I mean by that is energy is not required to make the reaction run, but rather we produce energy as a result of the reaction. Every time you eat food, you release energy. And that energy can in turn be used to build your muscles and your skin and everything else that needs to be built. So everything you eat that you chew up and break down in your body is going to be an exergonic reaction because digestion releases those ATP molecules. A little more complicated than that, but you know, that's where we're headed. On the very bottom of your page, there's a term called activation energy. So when our bodies do chemical reactions, and when they're endergonic in nature, they require an input of energy. So you may want to make a note there that activation energy is specifically for endergonic reactions. Okay, very bottom line there, activation energy. You may want to make a note. Yeah, these are required for endergonic reactions. Ender, E-N-D-E-R. So endergonic reactions are the ones that require an input of energy. That's like growing new muscle, making new skin. And all these reactions that make your body run require an input of energy. It just depends on what the reaction is and how much energy you need to make it run. Because some reactions require a lot of energy to run properly, we actually need a little bit of help making them go, and that's where enzymes come into our assistance. So what you're looking at here, imagine that this is a hill, and our job is by ourselves to push a 400-pound ball up and over that hill. Okay, so by myself, I don't want the tall hill, right? Because I've got to heave and shove and push to get that ball up and over that hill. Well, what enzymes do is they say, hey, I know you've got this job to do and this task to do that's energy intensive or endergonic in nature. Enzymes come along and say, I've got a shovel, let me help you out. I'm going to cut the hill by half. And so you don't have to work quite so hard to make the reaction start up and run. So you'll notice here that enzymes lower the activation energy. In other words, they make it easier for the reaction to run. Imagine this. Imagine if your car caught fire every time you cranked the engine. Okay? So we don't want to heat up your body to that point, right? We don't want to heat your body to the point of catching on fire every time you run an endergonic reaction. So enzymes are going to lower the amount of energy that you take to make that reaction run. Protein breakdown is actually quite energy intensive, so we use enzymes for breaking down proteins and other kinds of organic molecules. This is weird, right? Kind of foreign. Okay, so the take-home message here is some reactions require energy. They're considered what? Endogonic or endergonic, and if they produce energy, they're exergonic, good. Building reactions, do they require energy? Yeah, they do. And so they're endergonic in nature, and breakdown reactions or catabolic reactions are exergonic, meaning what? They break down and give off energy, right.
Which one
right now? Catabolic reactions break down molecules. They're exergonic, which means they release energy. Yeah.
I would use enzymes like after you work out. Because people do that, right? They take enzymes.
Probably for GMC. Yeah, probably for muscle metabolism. Yeah. Because if they've ripped or torn muscles, it probably has to do with rebuilding that muscle.
It has to be recovering.
Okay, now that is for energy.
Weird things to your liver too,
though. Yeah.
I'll work at GNC for a while.
Yeah.
We'll actually talk about CK, that creatine stuff, and yeah, we'll talk about that in an upcoming chapter. Yeah, some interesting stuff. All right, one last little bit on chemical reactions is page 18. So metabolism is how you feel today. You feel like crap? You can blame your metabolism a lot of the time, right? You feel great and energetic? Thank your metabolism. So metabolism is the sum of all your chemical reactions. It includes building reactions and breakdown reactions. We'll talk more about this one in 211, but this is just the tip of the iceberg here. Reactions that build molecules in your body are called synthesis reactions. They're also called anabolic or anabolism reactions. They're called combination reactions.
You said they build?
They build. So let's take your train cars. Take your individual train cars, link them together. You take monomers, you join them together to make a polymer. What's going on in your body when you're doing something like this? Can you think of an example? When might you take little pieces and join them together to make a big piece?
I don't know what you mean. Like,
When might you take pieces, monomers, and join them to make a polymer? Growing anything.
Skin.
Oh, hair.
Hair.
Fingernails,
muscles. Anytime you take little pieces called monomers, they're building blocks, and you link them together to make a polymer, you're doing one of these reactions. They're called anabolic or anabolism. Another name for them is dehydration synthesis. So when you're growing, you actually release water. How weird is that? So in order to join those monomers together, we actually drive away the water that's been stabilizing their valence shells. Oh gosh, we're back to that, right? Okay, so when you take monomers, the little pieces, the building blocks, and you join them together, you actually drive off or dehydrate the water to make a polymer. And so we have to show what happened to the water. Here it is down here is one of our products. So let me use an example that you're probably familiar with. You ever bake a cake? Okay, let's say that you've got flour, sugar, eggs, and milk. It's a pretty moist mess when you put it in the oven. You turn on the oven, you heat it up, you add heat, right? You use an endergonic reaction, right? And then what happens to the water that's in that cake?
It evaporates.
If you cook your cake for an hour and you open the oven door, blast of heat and steam, right? That's all the water that you drove off of the monomers. And, you know, lo and behold, an hour later, you don't have individual pieces of flour and egg and milk. You've got a polymer, and that polymer is your cake. Perfect example of an endergonic reaction, adding heat, or rather, in this case, it's, you know, ATP in our bodies, right? And then you drive off the water molecules. Compare what you see for the breakdown reaction. Catabolism is a decomposition reaction. And look at what happened to our products and our reactants here. What happened to their relationship? Flip-flop them, right? Okay? So this time we're taking a polymer, something that's got a lot of pieces in it, and you're breaking it down into individual monomers. Yeah, so you're taking and chopping it up, essentially. What do you have to add to this reaction as a reactant in order to make this reaction run?
Water.
Yeah. So if you've ever heard that you have to drink so much water per day for your body to function, it's this right here. Okay. So if you want to lose weight, don't skimp on the water, because the water is what allows your body to break down all the fats or even proteins that you might be using. So if you starve yourself of the water, you're going to get it from somewhere, and that's going to be your cells. So these kinds of reactions release energy. If you release energy, what do you call them?
Exergonic.
They're exergonic, right. So endergonic and exergonic only tells us if water, ATP is added or released. Anabolism or anabolic reactions and catabolic reactions describe simply if we're building or breaking down those molecules.
I have one question.
Sure.
Not to get off the subject, but which reaction is it if your hair is growing and you're having dandruff? Would that fall under one of those categories?
Let's see, if your hair is growing, I would
and
say
you have dandruff.
The extra
what
skin.
What is the dandruff?
It's probably extra skin. It's probably anabolic, yeah.
Anabolic, okay.
Yeah. Because if you want it to stop growing, you know, if you could somehow make the skin stop growing, not that you want that to happen,
right.
But if you could stop it from growing, then you would slow down those anabolic reactions.
Okay.
That would be my guess. Yeah. All right. So we talked about baking a cake. Let's talk about soaking dirty dishes in a sink. If you soak dirty dishes in a sink overnight, what happens to all the food particles on your dirty dish?
Breaks down, breaks apart.
What are you using to break up those molecules?
Water.
Water, exactly. Great example of which reaction?
Catabolic.
Good. I know we haven't talked about these chemicals here yet. Glucose plus fructose yields sucrose and water. But by the location of water being a product, can you tell me if we're building or breaking down? We're building. So is this anabolism or catabolism? It's anabolism. Good. Digesting food requires water to be in your system. This sound like a building reaction or a breakdown?
Breakdown.
Definitely a breakdown reaction. And then finally, if you're growing anything in your body, whether it's new skin, new muscle, new hair, new anything, that kind of reaction is classified as what?
Anabolic.
Good. So it's a building reaction. Okay. So my goal today is to get you a little bit into some organic compounds. They're going to be over on page 19.
You said baking a cake was this one?
Baking a cake is actually an anabolic reaction.
So anabolic and the endergonic is the same. Those on the...
Kinda. Anabolic means to build, and endergonic means to use energy. So they go hand in hand. If I'm building, I've got to use energy. So if I say I'm doing a building reaction, you would want to say it's anabolic. If I say that I'm using a reaction that requires energy, you would say it's endergonic.
So synthesis and anabolism are the same.
Yes, synthesis and anabolism are the same. Let me give you another example. Let's flip-flop it. If I'm breaking something down, I'm specifically meaning what kind of reaction?
Catabolic.
But if I say I release energy, which I do, I have what kind of reaction?
Exergonic.
Exergonic, right. So it's just making sure you're on top of those words there. Breaking down means catabolic or decomposition. If you're releasing energy, which you are, it's exergonic. Anybody still need this slide? All right. Let me flip you over to page 19. I know that organic compounds are something that are probably not the most entertaining or exciting thing to learn. If you find that they just will not stick, I'd recommend flashcards for this stuff. And like we talked in class last Thursday, peel them off. As you start to learn them, ditch the flashcards that you know and only keep the ones that you can't get to stick. The organic compounds we're getting ready to talk through today and on Tuesday, well, these all contain lots of carbon. In fact, they have long carbon backbones. Oftentimes, they have hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur. If you rearrange those letters, C-H-O-N-P-S, you actually have New Hampshire cops. You have New Hampshire cops. See how that works? So those six elements, the New Hampshire cops elements, are actually quite common in the four major organic compound groups we're getting ready to head into. We do produce these organic molecules, and most of these are held together with covalent bonds. Covalent bonds means what's happening between those atoms. They're sharing electrons. All right, so let me hit carbs first. Take a look at the word carbohydrate. There's actually some hidden clues in the word. The carbohydrates have carbon. That's the first part of the word. What does hydrate say? It's got water, right? And in fact, water is composed of hydrogens and what else?
Oxygens.
Yeah, so if you'll notice on your worksheet, carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens are typically found in a certain ratio. You'll notice it's CH2O. In other words, there's typically twice the number of hydrogens as carbons and oxygens. Hey, in plain English, you know what this means? This burns really well. This is great fuel. This is like putting a really dry little stick on the fire. Poof, it burns, right? So carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens are fuel for your body. That's the way we should look at the CH2O. This is fantastic fuel. So this category of organic molecules gives us energy. Sometimes it's a very quick burn of energy. Sometimes it's a slower, longer burn of energy, and depending on which category we're talking about will dictate how quickly we can burn off that molecule. Notice saccharide is common among these three categories of carbs. What does saccharide mean? Sugar. And mono, di, poly, what does that mean?
One sugar, two sugar, many sugars.
One, sounds like a nursery rhyme, right? One or two or many. So which one of these do you think burns the quickest?
Mono.
Mono. Gives you the longest burn?
Polys.
They make you fat too, right? So if you're going to go for a marathon run, pick which one? Pick the polys. They're going to last the longest, right? But if you don't run them off, you're exactly right. They turn to fat. But if you want a quick burn of energy, a quick boost, a quick pick-me-up, pick the monosaccharides.
So we feel bad after we eat a high carb dinner because we're digesting and slowing it.
Yeah, your diet and the blood's going to your digestive tract and not to your muscles and brain.
Yay.
And then there's insulin and all that stuff that's...
Right after that.
Yeah. Let me go ahead and give you a helpful hint. O-S-E as a suffix says what?
Sugar.
O-S-E says I'm a sugar. Okay, so anytime you see O-S-E, you've got a sugar.
Where do you see OSE?
It's not on there. Yeah, I'm just telling you. Helpful hint. Yeah, OSE is I'm a sugar.
E or C?
Like glucose, the last three letters. OSE. Okay, so this is a monosaccharide. Mono means one. It is a simple sugar. And you'll notice that it should contain between 3 and 7 carbon atoms. These lines should look familiar. These are just single bonds. Got a double covalent bond there. And when your body takes this sugar in, it sends it to your cells, and your mitochondria break it down and produce ATP, which is energy. Boom, you've got an energy burst after having had some monosaccharides. So you feel great, you're on a sugar high, then you burn off all your sugar, and then you crash. So that's why monosaccharides have both a good and a bad side to them. They're good if you want a quick pick-me-up, but they leave you feeling awful. They leave you with a sugar low after your body burns through them because they're really easy to break down. The one that your body is actually looking for is a sugar called glucose. Glucose is your body's preferred fuel. This is the sugar that we use to make ATP. There's other sugars that have the same numbers of carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens as glucose. In fact, galactose has the same chemical formula. It's C6H12O6. But you know what? Your body is smart. Your body says, you're not going to fool me. That galactose is not what I'm looking for. Even that little switch between the hydroxide and hydrogen there, your body says, you don't look quite right. You're not really what I want. I'll use you anyway to make ATP, but I have to do some conversions. I'll have to flip the locations of those those atoms there to make it what I really want.
So that's how you see the difference?
That's how you see the difference.
So how would you tell the difference in the formula if they are the same?
You cannot. Yeah, so since they're both C6H12O6, I would have to tell you which one I was talking about. So these are considered isomers of each other. Iso means what? The same. So they have the same formula, they just happen to be differently structured. Glucose and fructose are also isomers, meaning they have the same formula. But what's different?
The structure.
The structure. And again, your body says, you know, I know it's C6H12O6, but you know, you're not going to fool me because that's a different chemical, right? Look at the positions of your atoms here. This is quite obvious. CH2OH is over here on this side, but on the glucose molecule, it's actually just a hydroxide. So your body will take fructose and it will turn it into sugar that it can use to make ATP, but it would prefer for you to have glucose. So, you know, there's been a lot of stuff in the news past many years about high fructose corn syrup, right? And they say, you know, does it make us gain weight? Well, the jury's kind of still out on that, but if your brain is satisfied when you've had glucose to eat, they're wondering if your brain is truly satisfied if you've had fructose to eat. So they're wondering if that's really satisfying that sugar craving that your brain is having going on.
Does anything
truly, right? So, you know, a lot of products have gone back to sugar, and by sugar I mean glucose instead of high fructose corn syrup.
So will we ever have to name them or just identify as an isotope?
You won't have to identify pictures of glucose or fructose. I'll have to give you a little more information. Like, I'd have to tell you this is a carb. I wouldn't ask you to identify those as who they are specifically. Let's take two glucose molecules and join them together. In this reaction, we're going to drive off the water and create a more complex molecule. It's a disaccharide called maltose. Do you think this is a building reaction or a breakdown reaction?
Building.
Building, good. So it's an anabolic reaction. Notice the water's removed. We drove away the water so we can make this reaction happen. And this maltose here is a disaccharide. It's still a pretty simple sugar, but nonetheless, it's more complex than the monosaccharides we just talked about. Another one that you're probably familiar with is sucrose, table sugar. And table sugar is simply glucose and fructose joined together. We already talked about this reaction, but notice we're taking two monosaccharides, glucose and fructose. They make sucrose. And of course, we drive off and away water. Would you consider this catabolic or anabolic? It's anabolic, good. So what does that mean we're doing?
Building.
Yeah, we're taking two and joining them, making a disaccharide more complex. So yeah, this is a good building reaction.
Is that the one you also call dehydration?
Same thing, yeah, dehydration synthesis. You'll want to know that glucose, fructose, galactose are monosaccharides. You'll want to know that maltose and sucrose are disaccharides. And let's keep on going. You'll want to know that glycogen, starch, and cellulose are polysaccharides. Okay, glycogen, starch, and cellulose, you'll want to know they are polysaccharides. I know this doesn't look like a very interesting picture, but I'll tell you, each one of these little green things, these six-sided green things, those are all glucose molecules. And there's so many of them that they didn't even bother to draw the details. They just linked them all together and made this really big thing that looks kind of like a chain, or these molecules all linked together. This is how our bodies store excess glucose. We store it as glycogen in our livers, and we sometimes store it eventually as fat, because that'll be the next step after glycogen. So glycogen is just simply excess glucose being stored in your liver. We tend to store it there for about 2 to 3 days, and then your body says, I'm tired of holding this. Yep, I'm gonna store it as fat for you. So glycogen is the way animals store their excess sugars. You'll notice that insulin is the hormone that our bodies use to take extra glucose out of our bloodstream and then store it into our livers. This is starch. What are some foods that are high in starch?
Bread and rice.
Pasta. Pastas.
All those cheap sandwiches.
Yeah. The ones that they put on buffets and restaurants give you to fill you up, right? It's typically a lot of foods that are white in color, like pastas, breads, rice, potatoes. Those starchy foods do have a lot of stored glucose in them. You will feel full after eating one of them. You'll feel satisfied from your meal because, you know, glucose, right? Makes your brain satisfied. But, you know, the problem is if you don't burn off that glucose in these starch molecules, what ultimately happens to them?
They
stored as fat, yes. So if you're going to eat a starch, you want to burn off the starch and not keep the starch as part of your foreverness, right?
But they're the yummies.
They are the yummies. They're the ones that taste good, right? So yeah, the starches are a double-edged sword. They're comfort food. Yeah, they give you the longer burn of energy, but they'll be burned off only if you exercise and get rid of them, right? And then finally, cellulose is found in plants. It, however, is a type of polysaccharide that you cannot digest. What that means is it's fibrous and it passes through your body undigested. We always say eat a lot of fiber, eat fiber-rich foods. You know, those kinds of things make our bowels move. Why is that a good thing? Yeah, you get toxic. Things build up in your system, right? So we want to make sure that our bowels move. We don't want to keep the stuff in our intestines, let it keep on rolling out. So fibrous foods that contain cellulose are actually undigestible. So where do you get cellulose from?
That's stringy, fibery stuff.
Yeah, green leafy vegetables, string beans, leafy foods,
collards,
yeah, lettuce, spinach, those kinds of things. So cows have cellulase, an enzyme to break down cellulose. We do not, so we just pass it through our bodies undigested.
Is that still a starch?
It's not a starch. It's just a carb, but it's not really a carb that we can use for any nutrition. So it's
doesn't count.
It doesn't count, yeah. Let's start with page 20 on Tuesday, and we'll finish up our organic compounds, and we'll try to start cells on Tuesday as well. Y'all have a great weekend.
Mm-hmm.